Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
This is Tim Staples of Catholic Answers. I'm excited to let you know that I also teach high school apologetics for homeschoolconnections.com, an online Catholic curriculum provider. There are also recorded independent learning courses at homeschoolconnections.com. Whether you take apologetics with me, literature with Joseph Pierce, or philosophy with Bill Donahue, or any of the other 400 plus courses with homeschoolconnections.com, it's a great way to get Catholic learning for your family.
Warning, the Catholic Man Show contains high levels of manliness. It's simple, really. You either want to grow in virtue and holiness, or you want to be a sissy, whiny baby. If you choose to move forward, grab your whiskey glass, because the Catholic Man Show is starting right now.
Welcome to the Catholic Command Show. We're on the Lord's team, the winning side. So raise your glass. Adam Minahan here, sitting with David Niles to my right. To my left, we have a very special guest, a friend that we have been trying our best to get on for about a year. We have to blame COVID for this. But luckily, we have been able to get him on the show. Father Aquinas Gilbo, he is the prior of the Priory of Immaculate Conception. Mm-hmm. And he is also a frequent provider of content for the Thomistic Institute, Aquinas 101. Mm-hmm. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Adam. It's great to be here. I'm glad we were able to do this finally after a year.
Yes, and you gave a great talk on the domestic church last night for the Alcuin Institute of Catholic Culture, which is a really cool part about like being here in the Diocese of Tulsa, like having this institute. And it was very well received. You know, we're finally getting to the point where people are interested in getting back together. So it's mm-hmm. just nice to have Catholics in a room together, eating and drinking and learning a little bit about our faith.
No, thanks for that invitation, too. It was a great event last night. Nice to be able to make the connection between the House of Studies and the Thomistic Institute and the Alcuin Institute. It's good to learn about you guys and also just the amazing things that are happening out here in Tulsa. It was great to be in a full room last night and then at Mass this morning at Holy Family Cathedral here in Tulsa. As I told you after Mass, it's been a year since I've seen that many people in church at one time. And so it's great to... Yeah, this has been a big boost for me. So,
is this your first trip to Tulsa?
First visit.
What do you think of the cathedral?
It's beautiful.
I just love it.
Yeah, I made a gym out here in the sanctuary is absolutely gorgeous, and the whole church, the windows, all of the appointments. Mm-hmm. It's great, and it seems like you've got a great rector there, other priests, deacons, and people who are on fire with the gospel. So it's great to be there this morning. So thank you.
And I played a little bit of a sales pitch on him that I didn't take him to Clear Creek Abbey on purpose this time.
I like it.
To bring him back.
There are other things to see.
You will have to come back.
Exactly. Yes. No. We're already planning the next trip, so thank you.
Yes. Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. So tonight we're gonna talk about temperance. We're gonna talk about the virtue of temperance, and we will imbibe in a little bit of a drink this evening.
Temperately.
Yeah. Yes. Torbeg.
Torbeg.
Torbeg. Torbeg. This evening. I've never had this. I've never even heard of it, to be honest with you. In fact, I'm getting to the point where if I go to the Scotch aisle and I'm not familiar with one, I just go ahead and grab it.
Might as well.
Because it's this is one I've never heard of before. Mm-hmm. You haven't heard of it either, Dave?
No.
But it's shaped by the Island of Skye. It's a 2017, the Legacy Series. They say it's aged in oak casks, and it's smoke and brine. It's kind of it has a little bit of temperately well peated is what
it says. Is Smoke and Brine part of the name or like the series or?
I think they're just part of the description, maybe?
Just part of the description.
Okay. Robustly peated and spirit with a deceptively refined characters resulting in a complex and characterful whiskey.
The nose reminds me a lot of Ardbeg.
Really? Well, yeah. The color even looks like Ardbeg.
The color also looks like Ardbeg.
Yeah.
But then, even more than that, on the nose, it's Ardbegian.
Yeah. Iodine.
Yeah.
Smell. So we're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass. Cheers.
Cheers to Jesus.
Cheers. Cheers, Juan. Juan on the buttons this evening. Did I mention that? I'm sorry if I didn't, Juan. I apologize, but we're grateful for Juan. He's been a huge help this weekend as well. We are sans Jim. He's feeling a little under the weather, so he stayed home this evening.
It is kind of like Ardbeg. It's a little sweeter and a little saltier.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it kind of, the initial, Father, are you familiar with Ardbeg 10?
I'm not.
It's a staple at my house because it's about $42.
Okay.
And very delicious. It's like real smoky, mm-hmm. real peaty, heavy on the iodine. Exactly all of the things that, like, the gross stuff right. that you, like, really treasure in a scotch.
But when you put it together.
Right, yeah,
nice.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So this kind of starts, to me, it starts off a lot.
This is really good.
In that
is.
Same way, yeah. And I think, so I certainly think that people are going to be more familiar with Ardbeg 10 than they are with Torabeg.
Mm-hmm.
But this has a sweeter... kind of up front, definitely saltier.
I do. I catch the salty. Yeah,
yeah.
I agree. And it's not that bad a price. I think it's about $55. So it's
okay.
It's not bad. It's a great, if you like peated scotches. Mm-hmm.
It's a medium length finish. I could, it's not a short finish.
Mm-hmm.
I could go for a little bit of a mm-hmm. longer finish but I think it's really good.
Yeah.
I'd say $55 is a fair price, personally.
Yeah. For those who may be just now listening, we've added a couple of stations recently in Texas.
Uh-huh.
Dave, why don't you kind of, this will also bleed into our topic really well. Why are we drinking on the show?
Okay, so we drink on the show for a number of reasons. First, the best reason is just because God made the things of this earth good,
mm-hmm.
and they should be enjoyed for their goodness. There's also just something about having a drink, smoking a cigar, you know, doing these what you might call stereotypically manly things. There's just something about them that facilitate a good conversation,
right.
that help you enter into things beyond how the weather is. You know, when you start smoking a cigar, like, you don't talk about the weather. Like, I don't know why.
Unless it's raining and it's tough to start the
right.
cigar.
Right, and then you start talking about, like, why are we out here right. smoking
this is a bad
cigars
idea.
In the rain?
Yeah.
We must be fools,
yeah.
right? But that's why we do it. It's just to facilitate good conversation and to promote, obviously, the virtue of temperance. It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to mm-hmm. do it. So, and if you're going to have a drink, you should have a really good drink, right?
Mm-hmm. Enjoy it for its goodness and enjoy the craftsmanship
right. of,
exactly. of a drink.
You know, we're not drinking a $12 bottle of whiskey. We're not going to have Bud Light on the show. Not that we're inherently against Bud Light. If that is your... If you say, you know what, I've surveyed the landscape generally of beer, and Bud Light is the thing that, you know, does it for me, great. I think you have terrible taste. But go, you know what,
right.
you do you, man.
Right.
You do you. So anyway, that's why we're drinking, just because we're men, and it is good that we do these things.
Father, so you enjoy scotch.
I do.
And you a little bit of bourbon as
bourbon
well?
Bourbon also. Yeah, I mean, the Dominicans, we were founded in Kentucky. So,
right.
the American Dominicans, we were founded in Kentucky. And so, not very far from where mm-hmm.
bourbon
was
trail.
Born.
Sure.
And so, early on, that was the drink of choice for American Dominicans. And still is, in a way. I do, though. There are some of us who have expanded, you know, into the realm of scotch. I can't say I know a whole lot about it, but appreciate a good scotch like this one. So, thank you.
Yeah,
for
absolutely.
Sharing.
So what are you guys got going on at the Priory? What do you have going on at the Thomistic Institute?
Why don't you just introduce yourself a little bit to our audience, for those of you who don't, for those of them who don't know you.
Okay, sure. So Father Aquinas Gilboa, as you said earlier, Prior of the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C., which is our studium, we call it, or the seminary for the Dominicans of the Eastern Province of the United States. That's the province of St. Joseph. There are four provinces of Dominican friars in the states, East, Central, West, and South. East, Central, and West all have their own seminary, their own studium. Ours in D.C., Central Province, theirs is in St. Louis, West Coast out in Oakland in the Bay Area. And we're also a pontifical faculty, which means that we grant degrees in theology on behalf of the Holy See, which is to say our graduates, if they get the pontifical degrees, they're church-accredited teachers.
Okay.
They can teach officially, let's say, in other seminaries or other pontifical faculties, and since they have the church's seal of approval. And so half of our student body are our own men in formation, of which we have probably about 55 to 60 men in formation.
No right kidding.
In our province.
Wow, that sounds great.
All together, that includes the novitiate, those in simple vows, solemn vows, and those who are ordained deacons. So everyone before priesthood ordination.
How long is the formation?
It can last, so it's a year of novitiate, 3.5-4 years of simple vows, after which then would be diaconate and priesthood. So it could take about between, I mean, the average is 6 or 7 years for for formation as a Dominican. First, you make solemn vows and then proceed to ordination after.
Let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. A coworker of mine, this is like back in the day when I worked in an office.
Mm-hmm.
Now I work from home still. But a guy, he asked me, because I'm kind of known around the office, at least I was, back when we had this thing called an office.
Right.
As like
in
the Catholic.
Before times.
Right, exactly.
The before times, right.
I was kind of the Catholic guy. So right. If anybody had a question about Catholicism, they'd ask me, which I really actually mm-hmm. appreciate and like. But he asked me, what's the difference between a monk and a friar?
Right.
And I said, I think it's a terminology thing, but I don't really know. And
right.
What is the difference?
So Benedictines would be monks. These are men who take a similar vow of obedience, under which is understood poverty and chastity, but they also take a vow of stability, which is they belong to one monastery for mm-hmm. for the rest of their lives. Friars was a term that was developed later for the itinerant friars, which is to say those who make similar vows of obedience and poverty and chastity, but they move around. They can live in different communities over the course of their life, and so that's a principal distinction between monks and friars.
Excellent.
Awesome. All right, so we're here with Father Aquinas from the Priory of Immaculate Conception. We're going to talk about temperance on the other side of this break. We'll be right back. This segment of the Catholic Man Show is brought to you by the Catholic Woodworker. Go to thecatholicwoodworker.com for heirloom quality home altars, crucifixes, and rosaries.
It's also the only place where you can get the official rosary of the Catholic Man Show. Type in promo code TCMS for 10% off all purchases. TCMS for the Catholic Man Show. CatholicWoodworker.com. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles. Here with Adam Minahan and Father Aquinas. Which is like the coolest name.
Yes.
You can thank my novice master for that.
Is that who?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
He made the decision. Yeah.
Did you like kind of clinch? Like,
right.
Like, or were you like, is
there a lot of pressure on you? You're like, oh, I'm Father Aquinas.
Well, first, yeah, it's cool. It's like, oh, but yeah. Then for the rest of my life, yeah. Aquinas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I got big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
So tell me, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, big time. Do you think St. Thomas, like, do you think you guys are the Dominicans,
mm-hmm.
but you're known, I mean, St. Dominic was awesome.
Right.
Like, awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But more people know who St. Thomas is than St. Dominic.
It's
like,
true.
He kind of, like, overshadowed his, you know, the order.
It is true. I think it's part of the the legacy that St. Dominic has in the church, that it's not his biography, it's not his own hagiography, not his own personal witness or sanctity. His legacy for the church is the order.
You know, mm-hmm. it's and the rosary. I mean, that's right. That's what I think of.
And so in the order and its works of preaching Marian devotion, but also solid theology, just the intellectual life to uncover and defend the goodness of creation.
Right.
Yes. And the superabundant goodness of grace. I mean, that's what. Mm-hmm. So he set up a way of life that was attractive for men, not only of his age, but of our own. The goal of the Dominican life is to be, yeah, a good preacher, a faithful son of the church and a faithful preacher. It's not so much to be another St. Dominic. That's not the goal. I think that's a way in which Dominicans are really distinct from, one of the ways in which Dominicans are really distinct from Franciscans. I think for a Franciscan, to become a Franciscan is to be St. Francis. I mean, to spend your whole life striving to imitate the virtue and the life of St. Francis. Whereas St. Dominic, when he died in 1221, he was basically forgotten. You know, he was buried in the church in Bologna. But then the friars just got on with it, you know, with life and didn't forget him, but there was no real cult of the founder in that sense. And so 15 years or so after the death of the of St. Dominic, a friend of his who had been a cardinal who helped him to establish the order himself becomes pope, is elected pope. And he's the one who goes to the brethren of the day and say, you know, you guys should pay a little more attention to St. Dominic. He was like my friend. I knew him. He was a holy holy man, and he should be recognized for his holiness. So you guys should probably start working on his canonization. How about, you know, send me some documents.
As the Pope, I'm telling you.
I'd be happy to do this. And so that's how it got started. So it's not that there's no love for St. Dominic, because there is. It's not that there's no appreciation for St. Dominic, because there obviously is, but it's but the love of the founder really runs through love of the order and what it is that he set up. Mm-hmm. That we share this common ideal of a way of life to dedicate oneself to Christ, but especially to his word and the study of his word and the preaching of his word. And and that's the gratitude that we show to St. Dominic, is to live that life as together as best we can.
So I know here today we're going to talk about temperance, but I just want to follow up on what you've said.
Sure.
Because is there something about the order and the order of the order that you think allowed St. Thomas to develop himself the way he did? Like, what if he was Benedictine or something else?
Because he almost was, right?
That's right.
Right, exactly.
That was his family's plan.
Well, right, that's what I mean. I don't want to say probably, but he might not have been the saint, been, you know, like himself in the fullness that he was. So is there something in your opinion that allowed him to be that way because of the order, because he was a Dominican?
Right. I think early Dominicans discovered him as a kind of talent as a young man down at the University of Naples. He agreed to enter the order. That's when his family tried to kidnap him and keep him from going. But they recognized in him a particular genius early on, sent him to study under St. Albert the Great, and then put him on the fast track in Paris to become a master of theology. And then once he attained those honors and those credentials, then he began to work after a series of assignments for the order itself, to organize studies within the order, to organize centers of study for the order. And in that, he was given time, space to study, to write, and really to develop the novel approach to study, to theology, to preaching that he did, which is redounded to the benefit of the whole church. So there was something, a short answer to your question, about the order and its governance and the way assignments work, just the prudence of his own superiors at the time, you know, allowed him to develop this gift for theology, for preaching.
What I was really thinking, you know, if you're a Benedictine, you just don't have time. There's not as much time to study, right? You're devoted more to the contemplative life and to prayer. So is there something like a balance between in the Dominican order, you
I think?
Think
this was the genius of St. Dominic. That's what he saw, that in his day, there was a dearth of preachers and a dearth of preaching. This had to change, and preaching for cities and people in cities. Mm-hmm. And so he knew from his own life that the monk is the kind of the perfect prayer. The monk teaches the Christian how to pray, and that has to be the foundation of preaching and study. And so that was Dominic's instinct, that to form a city preacher, you basically had to take the monk out of the country monastery, put him in the city, and take the shovel out of his hand, because that's what he was doing
right,
most
sure.
of the day, and you put a book in his hand. And so that's, you have this city monk, this city preacher, who dedicates himself, consecrates himself to prayer and to study of the word, but his work is study, learning, teaching, and preaching.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
So we're going to talk about temperance, and this kind of actually dovetails right into what we're going to talk about, the order of you know when we're talking about temperance, we're talking about governing and ordering our appetites for a order that is brings about peace, that brings about tranquility, that brings about the fullness of man. When we talk about appetites, maybe we should start with definitions.
Sure.
What are appetites, and what are the types of appetites to govern?
So appetite is just a word we use for that power in us that that desires the good. So that's the movement in us, which is a complement to reason. So intellect is that that power by which we bring reality into ourselves and hold reality in ourselves through the acquisition and possession of truth. Appetite is that power that by which we move out of ourselves into the world to actually grasp that which we know to be true. And because we know it to be true, we also recognize it to be good. And it's under the aspect of good that we desire it and love it and pursue it, possess it, and enjoy it. Now, we have two kinds of appetite in us, the rational appetite, which is the will. That's the appetite that's directly linked to intellect. So we call it the intellectual appetite or the rational appetite. It's the appetite of our intellect. So that which we know to be true by intellect, we, in a sense, desire intellectually by love. But we also have the sense appetites, which is those power, that power in us to desire. These are the passions. These are the emotions that follow upon not reason directly, but our senses. So once we see or smell or hear or touch something pleasant, it becomes desirable. Passions move in desire for them. And so we sense within ourselves and feel within ourselves two kinds of appetite, the rational appetite, the will, which is by the power by which also we choose, and also the sense appetites, the passions by which we, in a sense, hunger for the pleasurable good.
And a lot of times I think people mistakenly think that temperance and moderation are are interchangeable.
And they can be synonymous in certain circumstances, right? But
yeah, I mean, but people are in four cardinal virtues, which we've talked about on the show many times.
Yeah.
The very first thing he talks about is how that is a mistake. Maybe you can expound on that.
Yeah, I would say that I'd have to look again closely at what Pieper.
Well, I mean,
the mistake he wants to avoid. I would say that I think we can say that temperance has a moderating function in life.
Right.
Its work in us to perfect our sense appetites is to moderate their movement, which is to say, to make sure they move rightly in accord with reason. That the sense appetites, especially that appetite which we call the concupiscible appetite, which is that's the movement of passion in us that desires the pleasurable, sensible good.
Food, so, sex,
exactly,
eating.
And those are the big ones: the good of
drink,
of food,
yeah.
The good of drink, and the good of the marital union, sexual pleasure. And so those are, you know, the principal objects of the concupiscible appetite. Temperance enters in to perfect that appetite, to regulate, to moderate its motion, so that we desire the good of food, the pleasure of food that we desire, the pleasure of drink that we desire, the pleasure of sex according to right reason. And that we desire it not excessively, but also not defectively. So it mm-hmm. could be that you don't desire these things enough.
Right. Yeah, sure.
But in most cases, if we have a problem with the concupiscible appetite, it's because it's a little overactive and needs a little moderation in that sense.
That's certainly my experience. That's
the work of temperance.
It's been over a year since I've read The Four Cardinal Virtues, but I want to say that he was saying that temperance is more than just moderation.
That's right.
Right.
It's not that
they're not. There's a lot of overlap, but that they're not equivalents.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Moderation is the act of temperance.
Right. And the temperance does go beyond moderation, because there are some things where
if moderation has a kind of negative aspect to it, Thomas is going to say that temperance helps us to feel rightly. You know.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that it's not a danger, something to be avoided, but in fact can be enjoyed perfectly.
Right.
Perfect. Yeah. All right. So. We'll pick this up on the other side of the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. Sitting here with Father Aquinas, talking about temperance. Father, I think maybe we start with concupiscible appetites. Mm-hmm. Focus on that maybe a little bit more.
Sure.
Because that's probably what most men are struggling mm-hmm. to govern.
Sure.
And so
let's say what the concupiscible appetites are.
Okay, I'll let you probably can do it better than I can.
Yeah, so in the sense appetites, we can just make one general distinction between the basically two basic movements that we experience in our passions, the irascible mm-hmm. and the concupiscible. The irascible is that contending side of our sense appetites, that when we encounter some danger or some roadblock between us and a good that we're striving for, that can produce frustration and anger. It can produce fear, mm-hmm. if the danger is in fact threatening, to us.
So let's say someone insults your wife.
This is a post. We're not going there.
Just kidding.
Or the Blessed Mother.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yes, that's another one I was thinking. Have you read The Ball on the Cross?
No, I haven't.
Oh,
no.
It's a great book. Short G.K. Chesterton book. This will only take like 5 seconds. The whole premise is that there's this guy from Scotland who goes to London, and there's this atheist newspaper who's printing like insulting things about Our Lady, and he like breaks the window and jumps through and challenges this guy like to a duel to the death, because like no one talks about my mother that way, and it's like just awesome. It's so funny.
I'll have to pick that up.
It's like the easiest Chesterton book I think that probably that there is
that so. He wrote.
Yeah,
well, thanks for the recommendation.
Yeah. The ball and the cross. Yeah.
So on the irascible side, it's fear, anger. There's also daring, and that's all what fortitude, the cardinal virtue of fortitude moderates, just to make sure that we don't, by excess or defect, fear or get angry or, in our daring, fall away from the right pursuit of the good that we're seeking simply because there's some kind of danger roadblock mm-hmm. There. So that's what fortitude, its work is to moderate in us the irascible appetite. Then there's also the concupiscible appetite. So the irascible contends with danger or hindrances to the good. The concupiscible side is those passions that draw us towards that which is pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
So pleasurable goods, sensible pleasurable goods, are things that just naturally attract us. And those can be of all the senses, sight, smell, taste, hearing, but especially touch. For Aquinas, he says that the ones that we're really, that the passion really moves for is the pleasures of touch. And there he puts food and drink.
There's definitely
and sex, the big three.
A higher sense of reality in mm-hmm. when you if you see something, it could be an illusion.
Right.
It's hard to be illusioned by things that mm-hmm. you can touch.
No, I think today we really put a priority on sight. Mm-hmm. If you ask somebody which sight would you fear most to lose, which sense you would most fear to lose, and probably people would probably say sight, because we're such a visual culture
right. mm-hmm.
today, especially through mass media. But the ancients and the medievals and most of Western tradition understood that the sense that we rely on most and employ most is touch.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we come in this sense, as you said, with contact with reality. That's
right.
What confirms for us what the other senses tell us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the sense by which we feel things that are nice and pleasurable,
right.
And give us joy. And so that those passions that orient us and incline us towards the enjoyment of the pleasure goods can be excessive or defective. And it's the work then of temperance to moderate those such that we desire those goods in a right way. Or that, and this is the usual problem with us, that when we encounter or sense a pleasurable good, that passion in us for those goods don't stir up in such a way that leads us to the immoderate or irrational pursuit or enjoyment of that good. And so there could be gluttony in terms of food, drunkenness in terms of drink, or of lust in mm-hmm. terms of the immoderate or irrational desire for sexual pleasure.
So let me ask you this question. This is not a leading question. I really am asking you this. Are the virtues, I don't want to say absolute, but are the virtues truly relative, like per person? Or mm-hmm. Is there like a real virtuous amount that mm-hmm. should be universal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking of alcoholism. You
right.
know, somebody, obviously the right thing for someone who is an alcoholic is to not drink.
Mm-hmm.
However, while that might be the best thing for them to do, that is that still a lack of virtue in that they're not able to drink temperately? Or is that temperance itself? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is the answer to that question?
Complex.
Okay.
But it's a good question, and it's one that we do have to wrestle with just in terms of coming to greater clarity as to what the virtue does and what we should expect the virtue to do for us. So, in answer to your first question, it's yes and no. Are there objective standards of mm-hmm. the virtue, let's say, of temperance? Yes, insofar as for everyone, temperance is going to moderate the sense appetites.
Yeah.
They're going to help us achieve the mean between excess and defect. So that's going to be the same for everyone. What isn't the same for everyone is what the mean is between excess and defect. Mm-hmm. So for a 5-year-old girl, you know, the measure of food that's rational
exactly.
for her to eat
different.
Is going to be different than a 35-year-old man.
I don't know if you met Adam's dad.
I did.
Yeah, he did.
Okay, so obviously he's going to eat more than a 5-year-old girl.
That's
right. You know
right.
what I'm saying? Like,
exactly.
By a lot.
But
he can eat the 5-year-old girl.
That's right. Now, each is perfected by temperance, but that's going to look different, you know, for each of those two people. Same thing with drink. You know, some mm-hmm. people have just a greater tolerance. I've got, you know, friars in my house of Korean descent, and because of something particular about Asian genetics, they just don't process alcohol in the same way as mm-hmm. as we do. And so he just can't, you know, just gets physically ill, you know, if...
Oh, really?
If
that is a bummer.
Drinks alcohol.
That is a bummer.
And so, so what's rational for him, what's temperate for him is no alcohol,
mm-hmm.
you know, simply because he can't
mm-hmm.
have it.
Right.
It'd be imprudent and irrational for him to choose, in fact, to drink it. I think you can deal with addiction in the same way. I think it would fall under the similar category that if for some kind of physical or psychological challenge, the presence of alcohol in one's system causes one effects that aren't natural, let's say, to alcohol itself, well, then the prudent thing would be, you know, to avoid it, just to avoid whatever illness
certainly.
Or bad effects would come from it. And temperance would be there as the virtue to regulate the passion so that when presented with alcohol, one doesn't experience in themselves immoderate desire, you know, for it, because their desire is shaped by reality. Like, this is in itself good, but bad for me, and therefore
right.
I don't desire it.
Right.
You know, and that's the sign of temperance.
That's why I don't drink milk.
There you go.
Personally. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's bad for me, I'll tell
right.
you.
Yeah.
It's bad for everyone.
Yeah. And don't have probably a desire for it when you see it.
No.
Yeah.
So does that mean, like, is that a good sense, like, whenever you know, when you feel like that you've kind of governed your senses of that appetite, when you don't even entertain that idea, you've just mentally already said, like, nope, this right. is not good for me.
Right.
So, like, when Venerable Matt Talbot, he realized he couldn't drink. He didn't ever walk by the bar anymore because he just realized, nope, that's not an option for me.
Right.
I'm not even going to entertain that idea.
Right. And there are ways to do that. So, I mean, that... St. Thomas is keen here to make a distinction between, let's say, continence and the virtue. So continence is it's like an imitation of the virtue. It's getting us towards the virtue. It's the one who recognizes that this is bad for me, but when I see it, boy, I still want it.
Right.
You know? And I want it a lot.
Like dark chocolate.
Right, exactly. And because it's bad for me, I know it's bad for me. So an act of the will keeps me from indulging, but you know, the appetites, the passions are still stirring. That's a sign that we don't quite have the virtue yet, but by an act of continence, I can, you know, refrain from enjoying that good, and that keeps me in the realm of right reason. You know, I'm still acting rightly and prudently, even though I don't feel yet in myself that that the virtuous thing is in fact what my passions want.
Do you think temperance is the most difficult of all the virtues?
I think we find it to be the most difficult because it affects in us, I mean, real sensation.
Right.
You mm-hmm. know, and because those sensations are so present to us. So the sensation of, like, say, hunger, the pleasure of food, thirst, and the pleasure of drink, you know, the desire for love, and the marital union, obviously Aquinas, you know, says is the most intense of the physical pleasures. The work then, to regulate and to moderate and to make the movements of those passions rational, and even our enjoyment of those pleasures rational, yeah, we find that taxing, you know. We don't find working for justice as physically demanding.
Right, right.
As like growing in abstinence or chastity.
Right, yeah, because like with, what's the one where you're putting yourself in bodily harm, the virtue?
Fortitude.
Thank mm-hmm. you.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, I understand that, like, putting myself at the point of the sword, that's not a good for me. It's not good for me. I'll do it if I have to, right? You know?
Yeah.
But, so I have no, like, disordered desire, like, let's do that again.
Right.
Like, that was cool, right?
Yeah. Your daring is not out of proportion.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, like, when you're encountering a bowl of M&Ms, is it 7 or 8 M&Ms? Or 20?
Times 5.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Like, or is it 21? You know? Right. Well, if you had 21, why not 22?
Yeah, we get into these kinds of debates, internal debates with ourselves.
That's an indication, right?
And that we're not, we've not acquired the virtue yet.
Yeah. Oh, I definitely haven't. Yeah. No way.
We'll be right back.
Do you feel like God is calling you to go on a pilgrimage? Well, for the last 34 years, Select International Tours has been leading pilgrimages to holy sites all over the world.
And you want, when you go on pilgrimages, Dave, you want to make sure you have the best hotels, you're touring with the best guides, and every detail has been addressed.
And that's exactly what you're getting with Select International Tours. So, for more information, go to their brand new website, selectinternationaltours.com. They have been a sponsor of the Catholic Man Show for a long time now. Even during the COVID pandemic, they were still sponsoring our show. A lot of other tour companies were really shutting down. These guys were consistent. So go to selectinternationaltours.com to find out more information about all the great pilgrimages they offer all over the world. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles. Here with Adam and Hannah and the Father Aquinas.
The. Not A, but the.
The Father Aquinas. Is there another one?
There are.
No. Are you serious, Clark?
There's one in my province, actually.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. Father Aquinas Beale, who's currently at one of the campus ministers at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
Do you guys have, like, rock, paper, scissors contests or, like, to see?
Well, he's
like,
the prior.
That's right.
So, like, yeah. Oh, I guess
the community took care of that for me. Yeah. Yeah. They just elected me prior and that's it. Yeah.
Really funny thing that happened in this room not too long ago. Adam and Juan were going to have a rock, paper, scissors contest. I don't even remember what it was about, but Juan, right before they did it, he goes, "I'll just let you know, I always throw a rock." And Adam looked at him like, You could tell it's just like a total mind job on Adam. He's like, are you serious?
This or
like,
yeah,
are you
yeah.
playing me? What, like,
what do I do now?
Are you about to throw scissors? Because you know I'm going to throw paper? Is that what... you know what? He threw rock. It was like so funny. The whole thing. It was the best.
It's an honest man.
Right. It's like, I was just sitting there as a spectator going like, this is incredible. I always...
This is the quality stuff that happens to your father.
I always throw rock.
Okay. Temperance. Temperance.
Temperance.
We're talking about temperance. So, okay. So we kind of touched on cuspal. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll brush on the irascible and then mm-hmm. talk about how to continue to develop it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So irascible appetite, go.
Yeah, so those again are, you know, whenever we've got some difficulty in pursuing the good that we have set out to attain, if it's threatening to us such that the continued pursuit of the good might cause us harm,
mm-hmm.
the response is fear, you know, or if it's just something that is you know, aggravating, slowing us down, delays our enjoyment of that good. That can be anger, you know.
And
it can be sorrow.
Oh, sorry, I didn't
you know. And so those are, you know, other kinds of reactions. It could also spark in us daring. You know that instead of being patient and enduring, we attack.
Is daring a negative in this sense?
No, it's positive. Because
okay.
I
could see it in either way.
After we evaluate the situation, it could be prudent, you know, that we, in fact, attack it. But Aquinas says that, in fact, the larger part of fortitude is actually enduring our fear.
Yes.
So that we don't, because of that fear, fall away from the just pursuit of the good. Mm-hmm. And here for him, the icon of the courageous person is the soldier, you know, who on the battlefield, because of the nobility of the objective, endures the fear of putting his life at risk in order, you know, for the objective to be won. And so that's why we hail the soldier and the courage of the soldier in itself, but also see that as the real model and example of what fortitude is.
That's what Don Quixote says. It's better to err on the side of recklessness than cowardice.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got to err on one side.
Right. I mean, because at least, that there's still action towards the end.
Yeah.
That you're not shrinking away irrationally, but... attacking
obviously,
it maybe irrationally.
Obviously, don't err on either side.
Right.
You know, but
if you had to,
But
no,
you can
see that.
You can see,
I can see what he means by that.
Sure.
And you can see the bridge that happens, how these both can be attacked, right? When you get angry, sometimes that falls into lust. Or fear, sometimes you eat too much to the point of gluttony. Like, they can kind of bleed into one another.
Sure. And you also find in the opposite... the remedy. So for you know, sorrow that may come from disappointment or frustration, the proper enjoyment of food or drink could be, you know, a remedy for that. Or for anger, you know, the meekness that's proper to temperance, you know, could be a remedy, just to make sure that we're angry in the right kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
Or the humility that's proper to temperance can also shape our desire to, or temper our desire to do great and noble things, that we do them not simply to be recognized or become famous by what we do, but we pursue it because of the nobility of the act itself, because the good should be itself achieved, and that I pursue that, especially if I'm capable of attaining great goods, that I do that with humility.
So, Father, you know, one of the greatest pursuits in life is that of self-mastery.
Mm-hmm.
Temperance is a huge,
fundamental
part of this. You know, mm-hmm. the four cardinal virtues, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that I'm different from most people in this regard, that I find it much easier to either fast, you mm-hmm. know, absolute, you know, just abstain,
mm-hmm.
than, you know, I cannot eat three M&Ms.
Right.
You know what I mean? I just can't do it. And I know that if I were perfectly virtuous, I would not desire that which was more than I should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I would be able to satisfy 100% of my desires, and it would be just right. My desires are not there, right? And so, how can I? how do I get there? You know what I mean? Like, I know that it's a habit. I need to, like, somehow practice it. But even in saying, I'm going to limit myself to five M&Ms, that I understand is that's probably part of it. But I'm still, in that sense, not... I still desire more.
Yeah, it's almost easier to say,
but that's okay.
No, I'm not going to do any of it.
Okay, so that's okay.
Well, because it's not going to happen immediately or immediately overnight. So on the one hand, I think it's to recognize, first of all, that if we indulge the immoderate movement of passion, we're only going to get more of the immoderate movement of passion.
Okay. You know? That makes sense.
In any realm. Yeah. So... if you can't eat only five M&Ms, but it's always going to be 55
right.
M&Ms.
Well, there's typically not that many.
Every time you eat 55 M&Ms, you're going to continue to want 55 M&Ms.
Right. Yeah.
And so you get smart about it. You come up with a plan. You attack it, you know, in a rational kind of way. So what is it like then to only have five M&Ms? So you see, you have five and you stop. Walk away
do
from
I eat
something
them
else
in one bite or five separate one M&M bites?
I'd say separate. Yeah.
Okay.
I would start there.
Prolong it.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Make it string it out
and then
okay.
stop. Okay. And then there's going to be a kind of delight there. I mean, from you've had the chocolate, but then because you had a moderate amount, a rational amount,
maybe
it's also
six.
Gonna,
maybe six would be a more prudent number. Seven is a perfect number.
Well, this is where you're going to start getting yourself.
You
in
see
trouble.
What I'm doing?
Yeah, and
this is it.
No,
right
you set a plan and you stick to it, and over time there'll be an experience of the delight of having a rational, reasonable, prudent amount of the pleasure, and you'll begin to delight in that more than just gorging yourself. Absolutely satisfying the basic just sense pleasure for the satisfaction of the sweetness of the candy, but also, and Aquinas says this, it's the feeling, it's the sense of touch in the stomach because it's full and more than full. We have to get to a point where we experience the delight and pleasure of the moderate amount, and we have to like that more than the feeling of being gorged. And however we get there, you know, that's the first step.
Right.
And then over time, yeah, you'll become more and more satisfied by the delight of the moderate amount and more, in a sense, disgusted by the feeling, even the idea of the immoderate amount. I think that's important to know about what the temperate movement of the passion is. It's not, for Aquinas, the cessation of passion or the quashing of passion, the absence of passion. No, it's the right movement of that passion towards the right kind of satisfaction of the passion. So the temperate man is the one who prefers the fine meal to the quick thing from Burger King or McDonald's. Sometimes that's necessary, but you prefer, you know, nutritious, well prepared and well set kind of food. It's the one who, as you were joking at the beginning of the show, it's the one who prefers Torbeg to Bud Light.
Right,
you know,
right. Yeah.
And also in the realm of sexual pleasure, it's the husband who takes absolute delight in his wife, and enjoys her company, especially in intimate moments, and
is in fact in all kinds of ways,
and then is in fact repulsed by even the idea of enjoying that pleasure with anyone else,
right?
Or outside of her in general.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so that's a sign that you've, you know, that's what temperance looks like. It's the man who enjoys all of these goods and all of these pleasurable goods according to right reason, which is to say according to also to his circumstances, state of life, age, marital status, you know.
Yeah.
All of those things go into helping to determine what is prudent and rational.
One of the things that I've been reflecting on, or it certainly was at the very beginning of Easter, I was kind of looking back on my Lent. Last year I did Exodus 90. This year I kind of adopted the practices of Exodus 90 during Lent. And what I decided is that for next year, instead of abstaining from these things, I'm going to do exactly kind of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. If there's a social setting, I will have one beer.
Right.
I will not abstain from beer. Mm-hmm. I will not abstain. I will have one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that if you're at a birthday party, like, for 4 hours,
right,
it's hard to have one beer.
Right.
Do you have it right away? Do you wait?
Right.
Put it off an hour? You know what I mean? But, like, to do that instead of... Because I don't have an addiction. I'm not addicted mm-hmm. to chocolate. I'm not addicted to these things, right? And so I don't actually need to... Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
I think that's what I'm going to do next year.
It should be harder.
I think it will be harder.
Yeah, because I would rather just not have any.
Exactly.
Have just a little.
It's right. Zero or gluttony. Like, those are the easy
I
ends
of
the spectrum.
I got lots of thoughts
spectrum.
On that, especially how it appear, applies to Lent. But
well, okay.
We might have to save that for another show.
Well, after this...
How about that for
we're done,
myself
we're done
on
with
again.
The radio section. The podcast will continue right after this if you have a few minutes
sure.
to share your thoughts with us. So if you want to hear Father Aquinas' thoughts, go to thecatholicmanshow.com, download our podcast. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
And cheers to Jesus.
Cheers.
This is perfect. This is perfect. I'll cheers you one. Oh. You want some more?
Oh, you'd like a little bit more.
Mas, por favor?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to almost do that, but... But you'd also have to be giving... I mean, it's... Well,
yeah, you, just like a warm-up, as they say in the in coffee world.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, that's plenty. Thank you.
I spilled a drop. Two it's drops. Okay. That's alcohol abuse.
So what were your thoughts on that?
So I do think that there's something that people approach Lent, I think, by and large, I mean, with the best of intentions. So this isn't to fuss at or... to denigrate anyone, especially in their Lenten practices. But I think there is something that the way people approach Lent as a kind of feat of strength, that and it doesn't have any real value outside of proving either to themselves or to others or maybe to God, you know, just how strong they are. Like, I love you enough, you know, not to have this pleasure for 40 days. And the concentration is so put on not failing in the penance, such that if you fail in the penance, like, Lent is busted.
Great.
You know?
You're done.
All right.
Yeah.
Whatever.
And so, like, the idea that you would, like, Sundays aren't included in kind of what your Lenten penance, like, is anathema to them because, that's breaking your penance.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I'm glad you said that because it was like,
but it's never.
Oh, I don't do it on Sundays.
Right, that's right. Well, no, but I mean, it was never. I mean, that's why Lent is longer than technically 40 days because the Sundays were never counted
right.
or included.
Right.
Now, it doesn't mean you go hog wild, you know, on Sunday, but it was recognized that it's the Lord's Day still, and it's not a day of
it's Easter
of
I mean, maybe your Sundays
fasting.
Look different
right.
in Lent than they do in Easter,
exactly.
you know, but whatever.
But I think the pressure that people put on themselves about not failing in their penance is an indication that there's a misunderstanding of what this is for, you know, in terms of denying ourselves certain pleasures to grow, to open up the soul and the spirit to prepare itself to celebrate, you know, Easter, you know, well. And so I think this kind of approach to penance where, it could be seen as a moment where I try to grow in temperance. And the way to do that is not simple, complete abstinence, but teaching ourselves to enjoy these pleasures in a more moderate, temperate kind of way.
Yeah.
And it also avoids the ostentation of that many people experience in Lent, like to go to a party and say, well, yeah, I can't, you know, have all that. Well, what is...
Right, it's a holier than thou.
That
like,
just shows
look at
that,
me,
yeah,
look at what I can do.
I'm fasting and therefore,
right.
you know, especially if you're the guest and someone has offered you this in charity and
right.
you say no because, that's...
Especially if they made dinner because you were coming over, or they made dessert because you were coming over.
Right. And just like, say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't.
That happens all the time on Fridays, right? You go to a non-Catholic friend's house and... you get there and you can just smell brisket on, you know, and you're like, oh no, you know,
right.
But it's not
easily avoidable though, by simply telling them like someone
ahead of time.
Yeah. Like just, so you know, like I don't eat meat on Fridays. I'm Catholic. And it
right.
actually opens up a great conversation.
Right.
But if it's the last minute, you know,
right.
like
It's happened to me several times.
The,
like, right. I'm just going to do
the
it.
The church, in her wisdom, gives you other options.
Other options, you know? Yeah. And it's like, I'll just do something else.
Yeah.
And it's not because I want
to
eat.
Maybe for a lot of people, eating the meat is the sacrifice. Like, right. Like they're freaking out about it. You know,
a kind
I mean?
Of mortification, yeah. Of that can correct a kind of improper sense of what
right.
the Lenten practices are for. Yeah, I don't want to like over kind of emphasize the or overstress the error here or give it more
or
points
down,
than it has.
Downplay right. the penance. Right. Yeah.
That's right. But it's like, there is a I think there's a lot to learn from the church's fasting laws as they exist now, especially looking at not the exceptions, but the mercy and the charity that the church employs in directing the life of penance. It can seem overly indulgent, especially if you compare it to other traditions or even earlier practices. But I think there's a lot of wisdom in terms of building up virtue that, mm-hmm. that informs the church's practice. Now that yeah, we can tend not to appreciate if we only see these practices, again, as kind of feats of strength.
Right. Well, you know, Father, we live in a time of plenty.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a world of easiness. Men are made, we're made for difficult, arduous things. That's why right. we're strong. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, there is nothing hard in the life of an American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wake up in your, on your memory foam bed.
Right.
You know, in just like absolute comfort, you get out and you're climate controlled. You take a hot shower. You mm-hmm. put on your luxurious, you know, like cotton clothes have never been as awesome as they are right. today. I don't know if you know right. that because you wear this like just lovely habit, but
a wool blend,
right? Yeah, yeah. Like the undershirts that they have today, nothing like right. they were like when I was born, right? And so, like, you get in your car, you
Which
go drive
also
to your
climate
office,
control.
Right. right? Exactly. It's like I don't think that like 100 years ago, men were excited to mow their yard. I get excited
right,
to
right.
mow. It's like, oh yeah, I get to do like this. I'm going to be a man today. You know, like I haven't been a man the other days of the
right,
week,
right.
you know? So I think the same kind of thing applies to Lent that,
mm-hmm.
oh, finally,
right.
I get to do something that I was made for. Like mm-hmm. I'm going to do something hard. It's kind of a sign of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just know that in my own life, my desires, my appetites, they're not formed.
Mm-hmm.
I have disordered appetites. I know that about myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I need rules. So I think that if my appetites were formed, I could use Lent as a time where I would actually go against, you know, like what my appetites were. But instead, mm-hmm. I have to use Lent as a time to try to form them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like this is right. a good time for me to like set extra rules for myself. And when I approach Lent, I try to do it in such a way that when I'm done with Lent, I'm actually going to have a habit that I mm-hmm. walk away with. Right.
right. No, I think that's a much better approach to Lent than, and I that should be part of one's goal. When entering Lent is to choose a kind of penance, as you said, that one can take with you can take with you after, you know, Lent is over. You carry over, mm-hmm. you know, into the rest of the year. At the same time, I would want to say that, Lent is not like the Catholic New Year, which is to say that this is when we kind of work on our resolutions
right.
for self-improvement.
Sure.
Or it shouldn't only be that. I mean, that
right.
could be an element of it. But it really is. I mean, it's the period for the believer who should already be seeking all year long growth and virtue and living the life of grace.
Mm-hmm.
But that's intensified in the weeks of Lent in order to prepare for the celebration of Easter. There's something we read in the Office of Readings in the very first week of Lent. I forget who it's by, but just making this point. Let's not forget that the whole of life is a life of penance.
Mm-hmm.
It should be. You know, the whole
sure.
of life is a life of growth and virtue, deepening one's prayer, deepening one's cooperation with grace. And that's intensified in Lent because of the intensity of the church's celebrations of
yeah,
Easter.
Sure.
Because of those, because it's the Sunday of Sundays. You know, we have the preparation mm-hmm. of preparations, you know, in that time. So, that's the other reason I don't like the kind of feat of strength idea about Lent, because it says that, well, it's only during these weeks that I do this. The rest of the year, you know.
I'm soft.
It's a free-for-all.
Yeah. So it was Exodus 90 that really taught me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just, which I did Exodus 92 years ago, and now I've continued. I fast on Wednesdays and Fridays. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it taught me... I've said this so many times in this podcast. Exodus 90 changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
Big time. And I think that if my appetites were formed and I desired the right things,
mm-hmm.
my Lent would be so much different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I know that it's they're just not.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to form them. I don't know. I don't know that I'll ever... I'll probably die with unformed appetites, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that. Not that it's not possible for the Lord to, right. like...
But it gets right. easier, right? As you continue... It's the initial going through the trenches of forming the appetites that's the heart. As mm-hmm. you continue to see the true, the good, the beautiful of the virtuous life, it becomes easier to live that virtuous, to strive for yeah. that.
So let me ask you this, Father. Mm-hmm. For someone just like hypothetically, you have a man who he's not new to the Catholic faith. You know, he knows the faith, but he, you know, struggles to... He wants to be holy. He's pursuing holiness. Mm-hmm. He's pursuing Christ. What is a good Lent? And I'm talking about a man in general, so mm-hmm. you know, it's difficult for you to answer. I understand.
Right.
What's your answer?
I think it's following just the church's counsel. It's again what we read on Ash Wednesday in the gospel that's put before us. It's some combination of three things: prayer, fasting, and almsgiving.
Mm.
So the prayer gives it, obviously, its spiritual orientation. One meditates on the Word of God and converses with God, deepens one's faith by making acts of faith, hopefully in a newer and deeper way. One enters more into the communion of truth with God, which is the foundation. As Aquinas says, that's the beginning of eternal life in us. And so that you have to begin there. So deepening faith and undertaking the prayer that strengthens faith. The fasting is there, in fact, to support the prayer, you know, because the more that are, the more that we, in a sense, deny ourselves and empty ourselves. That's the whole of especially the desert tradition, is that it's the emptying ourselves of the earthly pleasures that we attune the soul to enjoy and delight in more spiritual pleasures. So the fasting creates the room in life for prayer. So not only are we eating less, spending less time eating, by denying ourselves those pleasures, we in a sense sharpen our spiritual senses, because we're not so in a sense inebriated by physical pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can, you know, rely more or become more sensitive to spiritual pleasures.
Mm-hmm.
And then the almsgiving is, because maybe there's a way in which we can become overly self-centered in our prayer and in our fasting. Almsgiving helps us to recognize that we continue to be social creatures, that charity remains the greatest of the theological virtues, and that whatever benefits we receive from our prayer and our fasting, the fruits of that need to be shared with others.
Yeah. There's also a sense of security, you know, that you have in, I have a savings account. When you start...
Right.
Giving it away.
Right.
You know, like, you start to...
You're no longer relying on yourself. But
right. It's like a very obvious, like, oh, who is it that is... Where do I get my security from? It's not because I have a bank account, right?
And it loosens our grip, our kind of greedy grip on the possessions that we might rightfully acquire and rightfully enjoy.
Sure.
But there can be an attachment to them that robs us of greater expressions of charity.
Almsgiving is definitely my weakness in Lent. I give the same amount in Lent as I do.
You should try to be a little holier. Have you tried that?
Let's talk about that.
command me, my friend.
Well, this, I think, is where Aquinas can be helpful, too, because the way he talks about almsgiving is not just about giving money to the poor.
Okay.
For him, almsgiving is the general category which encompasses every act of mercy.
Huh.
So for him, the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, all of them fall under almsgiving.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And so I think that's a healthier way to see that it's not just about giving money to the poor, but performing the 14 acts that are recommended by Scripture in terms of, and they're both corporal, which is to say physical, but also spiritual. You know, they have their origin in the soul and their benefit in the soul. And really the point of almsgiving is to make us more merciful.
Hmm.
And in that, recognizing more and more how we are the recipients and beneficiaries of the Lord's mercy. And the only response we have to that is to show mercy ourselves. And that's almsgiving.
That's beautiful. The last thing I want to say is just to comment on a point you made just a minute ago. I have noticed in my own prayer life, the days, like I pray in the morning. It's the first, you know, mm-hmm. when I get up, I pray for about 30 minutes. The days where I have fasted, the mornings where mm-hmm. I fasted the day before, I tend to find I have a more, I don't want to judge my prayer life based on the way I feel mm-hmm. about my prayer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to feel more intimate.
Mm-hmm.
The days where like, oh, wow, we had like a birthday party yesterday right. and ate like two pieces of cake,
right.
you know, there's just I don't feel the same.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of that I realize is that we're body, soul, composites.
Mm-hmm.
And my body is an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And I experience the Lord through my body.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot experience right. Him apart from it.
Right.
And so if I have...
While you're alive, at least.
Well, yeah. And, you know, like... Right now, that's where right. I'm at. You know, so if I have... If I'm not as sharp, the instrument of my body, or what, I don't know the best way to say it, but you know, it interferes.
Right. I think the Desert Fathers knew this. They're the great teachers of this. That when the senses and the desires of the senses are constantly satisfied by pleasure,
mm-hmm.
that dulls our spiritual senses.
That's right. I just don't feel as sharp.
Because life becomes simply the pursuit of the next sensual pleasure.
Yeah.
You know, the next physical pleasure. And you're not concentrating at all on the higher goods, higher pleasures, spiritual pleasures. And in fact, don't even have the energy for it because...
Yeah.
We become slothful, you know.
We're disorder. Dragged down. I can feel it because it's not just when I eat too much or when I drink too much, when I don't get enough sleep.
Right.
If I'm tired, I mm-hmm. kind of have that same, there's like a barrier that is in the way. And it's, I think it just flows from a lack of order.
Right.
You know, I should have gone to bed on time. I should have, I was... It comes down to me prioritizing lesser goods over higher goods.
I think health experts, scientists, others who study nutrition and other things are rediscovering, I think, an earlier wisdom. I mean, the whole interest in intermittent fasting, I think it's just simply rediscovery of how it is that people for centuries, in fact, ate.
St. Anthony is still in the desert going like,
I told you guys.
I've been here forever.
But recognizing that there are not only spiritual benefits but also physical benefits, that we're not built, to have the stomach
full.
We're
not supposed to feast
all
every
the time.
Yeah.
And so I find that interesting, actually, because I think it confirms something that the wisdom that has been carried on through in the spiritual tradition of the church, which is a reflection of an earlier just practical wisdom as to how to live.
Yeah.
So that I think there's something to that and that there's something even physically beneficial about the kind of extended experience of hunger, not to the point of harming oneself or emaciation or things like that.
Right.
Even sleep patterns also, just the way that what we're rediscovering about especially the medieval patterns of sleep, maybe more natural than what it is that we do now.
What did they do?
They got up in the middle of the night. They had like two cycles of sleep, but they weren't, which we do too,
Kramer did this for a while in an episode of Seinfeld. I don't know if you remember that. Like,
yeah, he turned out. It didn't turn out well.
It didn't work out for Kramer, but also Kramer wasn't a real person.
Right. But it seems that people went to bed at sundown and got
up 4 hours
later.
Because they didn't have electricity either.
So, I mean, what are you going to do? It's time, you know, there's no more light.
You can only burn
candles for so long.
Right, yeah.
And
we have one candle. What are we going to do? You know.
And you went through one, maybe 4 hour cycle of sleep, and you woke up. And people kind of piddled around.
In the middle of the night?
In the middle of the night. And this is why I think the midnight office of monastics make a lot more sense. Not to say that's not a penitential quality to it, because that was the longest office of the day.
It was?
Yeah. They would be in there for a long time. But then when...
You got to have that memorized, too, because you're obviously like...
Because you're in the dark. With your one candle. But then you went back to sleep. After an hour or two, went back to bed and back to sleep and slept another cycle.
Was it 1 hour or two? Because that is a big difference.
Well, I think it was three or four. I mean, I think people still probably got 7 to 8 hours of sleep or even more. But there was a pause in between.
I think I could do that one time.
Right.
Like, it would be so annoying. You know what I mean?
But I think that was just their natural rhythm. Whereas for us, if you start going to bed at 7 o'clock, you're going to wake up at midnight,
right? Yeah,
and then you'll be tired again at 2, and you'll sleep till 6. Uh-huh. You know,
so they didn't have a nap, they didn't have the siesta.
Well, that's a good question. They probably still did, only because it's probably in those areas where the siesta developed. It was just so hot in the middle of the day, and you also had your main meal in the middle of the day.
I was just contemplating, brother.
Right. So,
do you guys call each other brother or friar? What do you call each other?
By our first names,
okay.
But in a more formal setting, father or brother.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Just curious.
We're all friars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on. Any of the keep asking questions, but I'm gonna what's the word? It's the present tense word for temperance. Like, I'm going to temperate myself.
You're
temper.
There you go.
I'm gonna temper myself. Thank you.
Temperate person tempers himself.
Words are hard.
That is our motto. It's one of our things. It's like we just.
It's beyond math is hard.
Words are hard.
Words are hard.
Have you ever studied Latin?
I do have a quick question.
Oh, Juan has a question. Yes.
Here we go.
Other than St. Thomas Aquinas, who do you recommend reading for?
No one.
Matters of
next question.
Oh, you weren't asking me. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Father.
For matters of temperance, which saint do you think has good words of wisdom?
Oh, gosh. Go to St. Thomas's teacher, St. John Cassian, you know, who was 5th century. Somebody can correct me if that's wrong. So he was a Westerner who went to the Middle East and to northern Egypt and lived with the desert monks for a long time, acquired their wisdom, and then went back to Europe, founded monasteries there. And wrote later in life all of his experiences and all the wisdom he picked up, you know, speaking to the desert fathers and desert monks. He's moderating a bit because he's writing for a different audience, a different people who live in a different climate with different temperament, different expectations. So it's the desert tradition already translated for weaker Europeans, our ancestors. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting. I mean, St. Dominic read Cassian every day. Aquinas read Cassian every day. And I think that's what you find there is the soul of Dominican spirituality.
I am so unfamiliar with him.
Yeah.
I've only heard of him.
I find him enriching for two reasons. One, he has an insight into human psychology that is phenomenal, especially for that age. But I think a lot of people... They paid attention to what happens interiorly, developed profound insights into our own psychology, but then develops lots of practical suggestions on how to because this is the problem and puts his finger right on it. This is how you deal with it. And so his two works, the Institutes is a shorter one, the Conferences are much longer. But in both works, you'll find just a master at diagnosing our spiritual ills and suggesting the remedy. And that's, if you are familiar with St. Thomas and read St. Thomas a lot, and you're also familiar with Cassian, you read St. Thomas and say, okay, well, this is, you can identify those
that
elements that he's pulling from Cassian. Yeah.
Great question, Juan.
Yeah. I had no idea.
Father, we can maybe end with your blessing. How does that sound?
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Heavenly Father, send your Holy Spirit upon us. Fill our minds with your truth, our hearts with your love, and bless us. Inspire us, encourage us, strengthen us in our pursuit of you. Deepen daily our exercise of faith, hope, and charity, so that in this life, but more so in the next, we may know, love, and serve you for all eternity. We ask you this, God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen. Amen.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much for hanging
out
with us.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Thank you, Father.
This episode is brought to you by Hallo, the number one Catholic app. Hallo has 1,000 audio-guided prayers and meditations for you to deepen your relationship with God. To listen to all of the Hallo meditations for free for 30 days, head to hallo.com/breadbox.